This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Last Days of Night by Graham Moore. Read for you by Jonathan McLean. Part 1. Salience. Don't you understand that Steve doesn't know anything about technology? He's just a super salesman. He doesn't know anything about engineering, and 99% of what he says and thinks is wrong. Bill Gates. Chapter 1. The Last Days of Night. People don't know what they want until you show it to them. Steve Jobs. May 11th, 1888. On the day that he would first meet Thomas Edison, Paul watched a man burn alive in the sky above Broadway. The immolation occurred late on a Friday morning. The lunchtime bustle was picking up as Paul descended from his office building onto the crowded street. He cut an imposing figure against the flow of pedestrians. 6 feet 4 inches, broad-shouldered, clean-shaven, clothed in the matching black coat, vest, and long tie that was to be expected of New York's young professional men. His hair, perfectly parted on the left, had just begun to recede into a gentle widow's peak. He looked older than his 26 years. As Paul joined the throng along Broadway, he briefly noticed a young man in a Western Union uniform standing on a ladder. The workman was fiddling with electrical wires, the thick black cables that had recently begun to streak the skies of the city. They crisscrossed the thinner, older telegraph wires, and the spring winds had gusted them into a knotty bundle. The Western Union man was attempting to untangle the two sets of wires. He looked like a child, flummoxed by enormous shoelaces. Paul's mind was on coffee. He was still new to the financial district, new to his law firm's offices on the third floor of 346 Broadway. He hadn't determined which of the local coffee houses he preferred. There was the one to the north, along Walker, and the slower-serving but more fashionable one on Baxter, with the rooster on the door. Paul was tired. The air felt good against his cheeks. He hadn't been outside yet that day. He'd slept in his office the night before. When he saw the first spark, he didn't immediately realize what was happening. The workman grabbed hold of a wire and tugged. Paul heard a pop. Just a quick, strange pop, as the man shuddered. Paul would later remember seeing a flash, even if at the time he wasn't sure what it was. The workman reached out for support, grasping another wire with his free hand. This, Paul would come to understand, was the man's mistake. He'd created a connection. He'd become a live conductor. And then, both of the workman's arms jolted with orange sparks. There had to be 200 people crowding the street that morning, and every head seemed to turn at the same time. Financiers parading in their wide-brimmed top hats, stock traders' assistants sprinting down to Wall Street clutching secret messages, social secretaries in teal skirts and sharp matching jackets, accountants out hunting for sandwiches, ladies in Doucet dresses visiting from Washington Square, local politicians eager for their duck lunches, a fleet of horses dragging thick-wheeled cabs over the uneven cobblestones. Broadway was the artery that fueled Lower Manhattan. A wealth heretofore unknown on the face of the earth was burbling up from beneath these very streets. In the morning's paper, Paul had read that John Jacob Astor had just become officially richer than the Queen of England. All eyes fixed on the man in the air. A blue flame shot from his mouth. The flame set fire to his hair. His clothes burned off instantly. He fell forward, his arms still wrapped around the wires. His feet dangled against the ladder. His body assumed the position of Jesus upon the cross. The blue flame fired through his mouth and melted the skin from his bones. No one had screamed yet. Paul still wasn't even sure what he was watching. He had seen violence before. He'd grown up on a Tennessee farm. Death and the dying were unspectacular sights along the Cumberland River. But he'd never seen anything like this. Epical seconds later, as the man's blood poured onto the teenage newsboys below, the screaming began. A stampede of bodies fled the scene. Grown men knocked into women. The newsboys ran through the crowd, not heading anywhere in particular, simply running, trying to pull the charred flesh from their hair. The horses reared on their haunches, kicking their legs into the sky. Their hooves flew at the faces of their panicked owners. Paul was frozen in place until he saw a newsboy fall in front of the wheels of a two-horse carriage. The stallions shook at their reins, lurching forward and drawing the wheels toward the boy's chest. Paul was not aware of making the decision to lunge. He simply did it. He grabbed the boy by the shoulder, pulling him out of the road. Paul used his coat sleeve to brush the dirt and blood from the child's face, but before Paul could check him for injuries, the boy fled into the crowd again. Paul sat down against a nearby telegraph pole. His stomach churned. He realized he was panting and tried to steady his breath as he rested in the dirt. It was another 10 minutes before the ringing of bells announced the arrival of the firemen. Three horses pulled a water truck to a stop beside the grim scene. A half dozen firemen in black buttoned uniforms lifted their disbelieving eyes to the sky. One reached instinctively for his steam-powered hose, but the rest simply gazed in horror. This was like no fire they'd ever witnessed. This was electricity. And the dark marvel of man-made lightning was as mysterious and incomprehensible as an Old Testament plague. Paul sat transfixed for the 45 minutes it took the fearful fireman to cut down the blackened body. He took in every detail of what he saw, not to remember, but to forget. Paul was an attorney, and this was what his as-yet brief career in the law had done to his brain. He was comforted by minutiae. His mortal fears could be assuaged only by an encyclopedic command of detail. Paul was a professional builder of narratives. He was a teller of concise tales. His work was to take a series of isolated events and, shearing them from their dross, craft from them a progression. The morning's discrete images, a routine labor, a clumsy error, a grasping arm, a crowded street, a spark of fire, a blood-speckled child, a dripping corpse, could be assembled into a story. There would be a beginning, a middle, and an end. Stories reach conclusions, and then they go away. Such is their desperately needed magic. That day's story, once told in his mind, could be wrapped up, put aside, and recalled only when necessary. The properly assembled narrative would guard his mind from the terror of raw memory. Even a true story is a fiction, Paul knew. It is the comforting tool we use to organize the chaotic world around us into something comprehensible. It is the cognitive machine that separates the wheat of emotion from the chaff of sensation. The real world is overfull with incidents, brimming over with occurrences. In our stories, we disregard most of them until clear reason and motivation emerge. Every story is an invention, a technological device not unlike the very one that on that morning had seared a man's skin from his bones. A good story could be put to no less dangerous a purpose. As an attorney, the tales that Paul told were moral ones. There existed in his narratives only the injured and their abusers, the slandered and the liars, the swindled and the thieves. Paul constructed these characters painstakingly until the righteousness of his plaintiff, or his defendant, became overwhelming. It was not the job of a litigator to determine facts. It was his job to construct a story from those facts by which a clear moral conclusion would be unavoidable. That was the business of Paul's stories. to present an undeniable view of the world, and then to vanish, once the world had been so organized and a profit fairly earned. A bold beginning, a thrilling middle, a satisfying end, perhaps one last little twist, and then gone. Catalogued and boxed, stored for safekeeping. All Paul had to do was to tell today's story to himself, and it would disappear. To revisit the images over and over in his head. Salvation through repetition. But, as it turned out, a flaming corpse over Broadway was only the second most terrifying thing that Paul Cravath would see that day. Later that evening, after his secretary had departed to her Yorkville apartment, after his senior partners had retired to their upper Fifth Avenue three stories, long after Paul had failed to leave for his 50th Street bachelor's flat and instead penned so many notes with his rubber waterman that the blister popped on his right middle finger, a boy arrived at the office door. He bore a telegram. "Your presence is desired immediately," read the message. "Much to discuss, in strictest confidence." It was signed, T. Edison. Chapter 2. The Wizard of Menlo Park.
"Hell, there are no rules here. We're trying to accomplish something."
Thomas Edison, Harper's Magazine, September 1932. Paul grabbed for his jacket and refastened his necktie before making his way to the door. He had been engaged in litigation against Thomas Edison for almost 6 months, but still hadn't met the world's most famous inventor. Edison must have heard about the accident. The very public death by electricity of a man on a city street. He would surely be preparing a response. But what would he want with Paul? Before leaving, Paul removed a folder from a drawer. He placed some documents into the inside pocket of his wool overcoat. Whatever Edison was planning, Paul would have his own surprise in store. Broadway was dim at such a late hour. The few gas lamps that lit the street painted the cobblestones with a thin yellow glow. Only one point sparkled in the distance. Wall Street, to the south, was a citadel of bright electrical light amid the murky smoke and gas of Manhattan. Paul turned to the dark north and quickly hailed a four-wheeled carriage. 65 Fifth Avenue, he instructed the cabbie. While the Edison General Electric Company still kept his famous laboratory in New Jersey, the company's main office had assumed a much more fashionable address. The man turned around to look at Paul.
"You're going to see the wizard."
"I can't imagine that's what his mother calls him."
"His mother died a long time ago," replied the cabbie. "Don't you know?"
The myth-making that surrounded Edison's story never ceased to amaze Paul. In less than a decade of public life, Edison had made himself into a modern-day Johnny Appleseed. It was infuriating, though one had to appreciate the skill involved. "He's just a man," said Paul, "no matter what the sun says about him.
He makes miracles, lightning in a glass bottle. Voices in a copper wire. What kind of a man can do that?"
"A rich one." The trotting horses carried them up Broadway, past quiet Houston, and the fashionable row houses of 14th Street. The island was dark until they made the turn onto Fifth. Suddenly, the electric lamps that lit the avenue became visible. The vast majority of New York streets were lit at night by coal gas. The same flickering light that had illuminated the city for 100 years. But recently, a handful of wealthy business owners had been able to outfit their buildings with these new electrical bulbs. Just a few streets contained something like 99% of the electricity in America, and their names were well known. Wall Street, Madison Avenue, 34th Street. Every day these blocks grew a shade brighter as another building was wired for current. The high-strung cables formed a fortress around each block. Paul looked up Fifth Avenue and saw progress. And yet, if he was successful. He would see Edison's illuminated empire torn down. Paul entered 65 Fifth at 11 in the evening. The bulky men behind the glass windows carried their firearms casually. There was no need for bellicose posturing. Only a very stupid person would have walked into that building unafraid. A bearded man of middle age met Paul by the building's central staircase. He didn't smile as he extended his hand. "Charles Batchelor." "I know who you are," said Paul. Batchelor was Edison's right-hand man, the head of his laboratory and his chief goon as well. If Edison required dirt be dug up, it was Batchelor who would till the soil. The newspaper said the two were never far apart, but unlike his employer, Batchelor granted no interviews. His face never joined Edison's on the front page. "He's been waiting for you," was all that Batchelor said. He led Paul up the stairs. Edison's private office was on the fourth floor. Batchelor opened the oak double doors and ushered Paul inside before hovering silently in the entryway. It was as if he were invisible when not in receipt of further instruction. The office was richly adorned. Chairs upholstered in Spanish leather. A glazed mahogany desk covered in electrical devices. A sleeping cot tucked into the far corner. The rumor was that Edison slept only 3 hours a night. As with most rumors concerning Thomas Edison, Paul wasn't sure whether to believe it. Along the patterned walls, beautiful electric bulbs shaped like roses had been affixed every few feet, and dear Lord, were they ever bright. Paul looked down at his hands. He realized that he had never actually seen his own hands under electric lights before. He could see the blue veins running underneath his skin. Freckles, pockmarks, scars, dirt, the ugly creases a man accumulates by the time he's 26. His telltale middle finger always twitching when he was nervous. Paul felt not only that the lights were new, but that he was. A spark of the filament, and he had been revealed as something he never thought he might be. Behind the deep mahogany desk, smoking a cigar, sat Thomas Edison. He was more handsome than Paul had expected, thinner than he seemed in photographs, boasting a strong Midwestern jaw. Even in his 40s, his hair remained unkempt as a schoolboy's. It would make a lesser man look old. It made Edison look like he had more important things about which to care. In the harsh light, Paul could even make out the gray of his eyes. "Good evening."
"Why am I here, Mr. Edison?"
"Straight to the point. I appreciate that quality in a lawyer."
"I'm not your lawyer."
Edison raised his eyebrows curiously, then slid a sheet of paper across the desk. Paul hesitated before coming forward. He didn't want to cede position, but he also wanted to see what Edison was showing him. It was a mock-up of the front page of the New York Times. "Met death in the wires," screamed the headline. "Horrifying spectacle. A lineman roasted on a network of wires." Down the column ran a fevered article denouncing the dangers of electrical power. The editors were questioning the safety of running cables stuffed with raw and poorly understood energy across the city.
"This is tomorrow's paper," said Paul. "How did you get this?"
Edison ignored the question. "Your little firm, what's the name? Housed right near there, aren't you?"
"I saw it happen."
"You did?"
"I saw the man lit up, and I was there when the fireman cut his corpse from the wires. But the cables on Lower Broadway aren't yours, and they're not my clients either. They're U.S. Illuminating Company wires. And since I'm not Mr. Lynch's lawyer, thank heaven, this has nothing to do with me, or the dispute between yourself and George Westinghouse."
"Do you really believe that?"
"What am I doing here?"
Edison paused before he spoke again. "Mr. Cravath, there's a war on, in case you haven't noticed. Within the next few years, someone is going to build an electrical system that lights this entire nation. It could be me, it could be Mr. Westinghouse.
But after today, it's not going to be Mr. Lynch. The press will have him chewed to a nub by morning. Sounds like a good day for my side.
Edison flicked ashes from his cigar onto a gold tray.
In the past year, he said, I have had many opponents to whom I might direct my attention. After today, I will have only one. Your client. Either I will win, or Mr. Westinghouse will win. It's that simple. My company is 10 times the size of his. I have a 7-year head start on manufacturing this technology. J.P. Morgan himself has promised us bottomless coffers for our expansion. And me... Well, I think you know who I am.
Edison took a deep puff from his cigar before blowing a plume into the air.
I brought you here to ask you this. Do you really think you have a chance?
He regarded Paul as a dog catcher might look upon a soon-to-be-euthanized stray.
Mr. Cravath, I invented the light bulb. George Westinghouse did not. So I'm suing him for everything he's got. He's a rich man, and you're about to squander his fortune trying to beat me at a game I've already won. By the time this is over, I will own Westinghouse's company. I will own your law firm. So stop. The line is drawn. Whoever is in my way is going to get hurt. For your sake, I am asking that you not be one of them.
There was a strange crinkle at the corners of Edison's gray eyes. It took Paul a long moment to recognize it. Thomas Edison was regarding him with concern. This was what stirred Paul's anger.
I'm glad you asked me here tonight, said Paul. You've saved me the trouble of having to make an appointment.
Oh? And what was it you'd wanted to speak with me about?
To deliver some bad news. You're being sued.
I am, said Edison, the slightest of smiles forming on his lips.
By whom?
By George Westinghouse.
My boy, I think you've gotten it the wrong way around.
We're countersuing you.
Edison laughed.
For what?
For violating our patent on the light bulb. I invented the light bulb.
So said the patent office. Only, weren't there existing light bulb patents before yours? Hadn't anyone else filed claims on any similar designs?
Edison quickly determined what Paul was getting at.
Sawyer and Mann? But that's a joke. Their designs were an ocean apart from my own. If they want to sue me, they're welcome to.
They can't, I'm afraid, because they don't own their patents anymore.
Paul held up the folder he'd pocketed before leaving his office and slid its contents across Edison's mahogany desk.
We do.
Edison examined the papers before him. His fingers drummed a quiet orchestration on the thick desktop as he read that the Westinghouse Electric Company had entered into a licensing arrangement with William Sawyer and Alban Mann. Westinghouse now owned the exclusive rights to manufacture, sell, and distribute electrical lamps employing the design those men had patented.
That is exceptionally clever, Mr. Cravath, said Edison at last.
Really? I can see why George likes you. The familiar use of Westinghouse's first name was a calculated move. Edison slid the papers back across the desk. He reclined in his deep chair before he spoke again.
I've looked you up. I hope you don't mind.
Can't imagine there's much to find.
Graduated first in your class from Columbia Law School 2 years ago, at which point you were given a tutorship by Walter Carter personally. Terribly impressive. 1.5 years later, Carter leaves and you follow him to his new firm. You're made partner instantly, at 26 years of age.
I'm precocious.
You're ambitious. 6 months ago, you were the junior partner at a new firm. You had never tried a case, and then, somehow, you managed to acquire your very first client, Mr. George Westinghouse, the man I had just sued for more money than you, your children, and your grandchildren will ever see in the total of their pedestrian lives. Mr. Westinghouse has an eye for talent. You are a child hired to be the lead litigator in the largest patent suit in this nation's history. I'm very good at what I do. Edison's laugh was a deep rumble. Oh, come on, Mr. Cravath. No one is that good. How did you get George to hire you? Mr. Edison, Paul said, why are you pretending to be impressed by me? What makes you think that my admiration isn't genuine? Because I'm standing on the fourth floor of the Fifth Avenue offices of the most successful inventor in the history of God or man, who registered his first patent at 21 and made his first million by 30, whose every utterance is printed in 38-point type across the front page of the New York Times as if he were the Oracle at Delphi, and whom the President of the United States and most of its citizens believes literally to be a wizard, whose name instills awe in the heart of every child with a wrench and a dream, and fear in the heart of every banker on Wall Street, and he thinks that I'm ambitious. Edison nodded calmly. Then he turned for the first time to his associate by the door. Mr. Batchelor, might you do me a kindness and bring in those files on Marianne's desk? Batchelor returned, bearing a stack of documents almost 3 feet high. Just on the desk here would be lovely, thank you, said Edison. Now, Mr. Cravath, you don't need me to tell you that these things here are lawsuits. A great many of them, by the look of it, said Paul with the briefest glance at the pages. 310, said Edison. There are, I believe, 310 lawsuits in that pile. And they are all against Westinghouse subsidiaries. 312, corrected Batchelor. The Rhode Island and Maine suits were completed this evening. Quite right, 312. You see, I'm not only suing you. I'm suing everyone you do business with. I'm suing everyone you've ever done business with. Every Westinghouse subsidiary, every local and state manufacturer, every factory, every sales office. The thing is, I don't have to win all of these suits, or even most. I only have to win one. You're countersuing me? Best of luck, because you won't need simply to beat me once. What you'll need to do is to beat me 312 times. Straight. Edison ran his fingers across the mahogany desk, past the mysterious boxes and sealed glass tubes and thin copper strips, to a black button at the far edge. Do you like the view? Edison turned to the windows. Beyond the glass, lower Manhattan rose from the ocean. The city shimmered in a glow of burning oil and gas, punctuated by the occasional flicker of an electrical bulb. You can see the statue from here. There it was, Lady Liberty, just visible all the way from Bedloe's Island. Paul thought back to his first visits to the city, when the arm was still on display in Madison Square Park, before the city had raised enough funds to build the rest. Paul and his friends would picnic under the shade of her elbow. The light from the statue was dim this far away, but its source was unmistakable. Electricity. The statue's torch was powered by an electrical generator on Pearl Street, on the southern tip of the island. It was Edison's generator. It was Edison's light. We've been having trouble with the Pearl Street station recently, said Edison. Some instabilities. He tapped his black button,
and suddenly the light went out. One tap of Thomas Edison's finger, and the torch on the Statue of Liberty 5 miles away went dark. Power can be such an uncertain thing. Gas was so predictable. You take a heap of coal, you heat it, filter it, pressurize it, strike a match, and voila! A flame that will light a room. Electricity is trickier. So many different kinds of bulbs. Different filaments, casings, generators, vacuums. One malfunction and we're all thrown back into darkness. And yet the old system of power is becoming obsolete. A new one rises to take its place once it becomes stable. Once it is perfected and ubiquitous, there won't be a going back. Do you know, the police tell me that all manner of horrid violence decreases in public places when my lights go up. Blessed with my brightness, men's working days are no longer bound by the setting sun. Factories double their production. Midnight and noon lose their distinction. The night time of our ancestors is ending. Electric light is our future. The man who controls it will not simply make an unimaginable fortune. He will not simply dictate politics. He will not merely control Wall Street or Washington or the newspapers or the telegraph companies or the million household electrical devices we can't even dream of just yet. No, no, no. The man who controls electricity will control the very sun in the sky. And with that, Thomas Edison pressed his black button again, and the statue's torch burst back to life. "The question that should concern you," he said as he reclined in his chair, "is not how far I'm willing to go to win. The question is, how far you'll go before you lose." A good attorney could not scare easily. A great attorney could not scare at all. But as he stared at the brilliance of the distant Statue of Liberty, at the dark devices on Edison's desk, at the 312 lawsuits that he had to win, at the pale face of a man who could do with one finger what generations of Newtons and Hooks and Franklins could not even conceive, Paul was scared. Because in that moment, Paul saw what real power was. Need. Power was the need for something so great that absolutely nothing could stop the getting of it. With a need like that, victory was not a matter of will. It was a matter of time. And Thomas Edison needed to win more than any man he had ever met. "All stories are love stories." Paul remembered someone famous saying that. Thomas Edison's would be no exception. All men get the things they love. The tragedy of some men is not that they are denied, but that they wish they'd loved something else. "If you think you can stop me," Edison said softly, "go ahead and try. But you'll have to do it in the dark." Chapter 3. Prodigies. It's necessary to be slightly underemployed if you were to do something significant. James Watson, co-discoverer of DNA. A year earlier, Paul had been an eager young prodigy with one of the most coveted positions in New York law, and not a single client to his name. In the spring of 86, weeks before his graduation from Columbia Law School, Paul had been personally recruited by the venerable Walter Carter. Paul accepted a clerkship at Carter, Hornblower, and Byrne to apprentice with Mr. Carter himself. If there existed a law student in the city who was not after such a position, Paul hadn't met him.
which is why it felt like the whole world was collapsing when, only months later, the firm began to dissolve. Suddenly, Carter and Byrne wouldn't even speak to each other. Paul never learned the substance of their disagreement. At that point, it didn't matter. The two split off into different firms, and Paul needed to pick a side. Byrne took Hornblower, as well as the majority of the clients and virtually all of the prestige. If Paul followed Byrne, he'd be a clerk at arguably the best-known firm in the city. Carter's new firm, by contrast, was to be a two-person operation. Three, if Paul joined. Carter had partnered with an untested attorney named Charles Hughes, actually even younger than Paul, but also engaged to marry Carter's daughter. Their family firm would have no clerks. It would boast no significant clients. It would trade only on Carter's name, which had been recently sullied by the rift with Byrne. And yet, because his new firm was so small, Carter was able to offer Paul something that Byrne could not. Partnership. To be sure, the split Carter suggested was far from generous, 60-24-16, with Paul in the minority share. And yet, at no other firm in the world would Paul have his name on the door. Did Paul want to be Byrne's clerk or Carter's partner? The firm of Carter, Hughes, and Cravath opened its doors on January 1st, 1888. Of paramount importance in those early days was the matter of attracting clients. Carter mined his decades of business connections. Hughes had been helpfully engaged in some minor but long-standing litigation for the Rome, Watertown, and Ogdensburg Railroad. But Paul had nothing more to work with than a handful of school chums and a decent sales pitch. By the close of the sixth week, having failed to bring in a single dollar to the practice, Paul felt his confidence give way to disappointment. Every hour that he spent alone at that desk, in the quiet of his uselessness, revealed him to be a fraud. His former schoolmates turned out to be neither helpful nor sympathetic. "Oh, that's so very Paul," they would say as he met them at their clubs for scotch. "It must be terribly hard to get everything you want." In point of fact, it was. But how could he illuminate the pressures and uncertainties of a position for which they would all gladly stab one another in the back? They wanted what he had. To tell someone jealous of his success that the very success was not what he might hope it to be, and was instead just another series of ever more demanding pressures and concerns, would be to sully his dreams. To dismiss his ambitions with what he would take, mistakenly, to be false modesty. Paul had always wanted to be a prodigy, but what no one ever told him was that prodigies don't feel like prodigies. They feel old. They feel like has-beens just at the moment that they're said to be blossoming. When they are praised for their precociousness or their youthful ingenuity, they will shrug it off because in their hearts they know themselves to be ancient and decaying. It is only later, after years of achievement have freed them of insecurity, that they will be informed that they are no longer prodigies, but rather merely brilliant successes. And they will cringe. Because they know themselves only then, in the waning of their prodigiousness, to be true prodigies. Paul had wished sometimes, very privately, to be a clerk again. And then, quite out of the blue, he'd been invited to a dinner at the estate of George Westinghouse. It turned out that years before, Paul's distant Uncle Caleb had taken a job at a Westinghouse subsidiary in Ohio. When Caleb had overheard a senior member of the company's staff despairing about their uncreative legal representation, he'd made a suggestion. Caleb had a nephew in New York. A brilliant young man, Caleb had explained. An absolute wunderkind who just partnered with the esteemed Walter Carter at the astounding age of 26. Mr. Westinghouse should share a meal with him. The kid might have an idea or two. When Caleb first sent word through Paul's father that he'd recommended his nephew to the Westinghouse Electric Company, Paul felt faintly embarrassed. He was mortifyingly unqualified for such a position. He could just imagine the polite dismissal with which Westinghouse must have greeted the mention of his name. Paul even wrote to his father to say that while the familial support was certainly well-meaning, it was a bit naive. This was New York, not Tennessee. Erastus Cravath responded with a brief message containing two quotes from Proverbs and a reminder of Jesus's warm embrace. It was not the first exchange of letters in which Paul felt that his father did not really understand the depth of the waters in which he swam. And yet, to Paul's surprise, a letter arrived 2 weeks later. Mr. George Westinghouse of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, requests the pleasure of your company tomorrow evening at dinner. On the way to Pittsburgh, Paul rode in a first-class train car for the first time in his life. For the entirety of the day-long trip, he kept his only good dinner jacket laid carefully across his knees. Paul's greatest fear was that the jacket, hand-pressed the previous night, would wrinkle. He had no replacement. He'd learned in law school that if you could keep a black dinner jacket crisp enough, you could wear it to every formal dinner without anyone noticing that it was the only one you owned. At Pittsburgh's Union Station, Paul was ushered onto the Glen Air, Westinghouse's private train. It carried Paul, and Paul alone, the 6 miles to Homewood, the leafy suburb where the Westinghouse family kept their white brick villa. A man designs enough trains, Paul thought, and they'll give him his own locomotive. Westinghouse got his own line. Dinner was set for 16. A few engineers from Westinghouse's lab, a visiting professor from Yale, some bigwigs from the railroad industry, a German financier whose name Paul never quite caught. Marguerite Westinghouse sat them all at a table of Sevres china and solid gold silverware while her husband tended to his salad dressing. Marguerite explained that such was George's way. No army of hired chefs would ever deter him from making the dressing, his mother's recipe. 20 years of marriage, and she'd never once prepared a salad for her husband. Marguerite's smile indicated a routine frequently repeated and still enjoyed. George Westinghouse greeted Paul with a firm handshake and a long look in the eye, and then utterly ignored him. Westinghouse was an imposing presence. He had a bear-like frame, burly mutton chops, and a grizzled mustache so large that it completely hid both his upper lip and the majority of the lower one. He was a few inches shorter than Paul, and yet when they stood near each other, the young attorney felt dwarfed. The dinner conversation was technical. Paul quickly gave up trying to follow along. The railroad men were old friends of Westinghouse's from the 70s, when they'd all become millionaires together. They asked endless questions about air brakes. One of them even attempted to enlist Paul. "Don't you agree with Mr. Jensen's supposition, Mr. Cravath?" "I'm sure I would if I had the least idea what any of that meant," replied Paul with what he hoped was witty nonchalance. "Afraid I missed the natural sciences at school, and the mathematical ones to boot." From the other end of the table, the look on Westinghouse's face made it clear that Paul's quip had been the wrong tactic. "The death of mathematical education will be the death of this country," proclaimed the inventor. "A generation of young men who have never even heard of the calculus, much less possess the ability to determine instantaneous rates of change? What will you lot invent?" "Well, nothing," replied Paul. "If you'll do the inventing, my lot will see to defending your rights in court." Westinghouse shrugged. He returned his attention to the creme fraiche that decorated his roasted pumpkin soup. Such was the sum total of Paul's contribution to the conversation. His one chance to impress Westinghouse and he'd squandered it. Paul took his embarrassment out on the Bordeaux. Who knew if he'd ever taste such an expensive bottle again? His despondent fixation on his wine glass was diverted only by an offhand comment from the professor. Just a few words half heard across the long table. Something about the physics department at Yale. A grumbling about a new PhD candidate. The usual grumpy gossip of academia, except for the one word that stuck out. A Negro in the physics department, said the professor, with a weary shake of his head. It's one thing to have a few in the college, but teaching? And teaching science, at that? Would you have the man lecture somewhere else? It was only after speaking that Paul realized he'd said it rather loudly. Pardon? Said the professor, clearly surprised. Well, Paul stammered. To go on would be insane, not to mention rude. And yet the wine did the talking for him. You'd prefer the man taught physics elsewhere, I suppose. That he dragged down those useless mutts at MIT instead?
Met more than a few useless mutts from MIT myself, said Westinghouse.
He was trying to defuse the situation with all due haste. Perhaps he might lecture in one of his own damned universities, said the professor. Unfortunately, there is no physics program at any of the Negro colleges, though I'm told there will be soon at Fisk. A generation that could have been lost to the fields will instead understand more about your air brakes and electrical wiring than I ever could. And how would you know that? Asked the professor. Because my father founded Fisk. A silence crept across the table. Paul had taken an awkward situation and magnified its power with the force of one of Mr. Westinghouse's steam engines.
Your father founded a Negro college, came the curious voice of their host.
The family tradition, Mr. Westinghouse, said Paul. Ordinarily, Paul took no particular pride in telling this story. He agreed with his parents' political proclivities, but he didn't go parading them around. Perhaps it was the wine. Perhaps it was the shame at being so out of place at a dinner of this elegance. Or perhaps it was simply the fond thoughts of the family who would gladly take him in to their Tennessee farmhouse when he failed in New York. My grandfather was an early supporter of a small college in Ohio called Oberlin. He'd been an advocate of women's education, and the school became his great experiment. Men and women, in lecture halls, together. I studied there myself. My parents met at Oberlin Seminary, married, and my father became a deacon. He served as a chaplain in the war, which led him to a cause that meant as much to him as women's education had to my grandfather. The educational difficulties facing Negroes in the South. He's a deeply devout man, and he felt, still feels, that God put him on this earth for a reason, and he'd found out what it was. A college that would do for the Southern Negro what Yale has done for the rich New Yorker. There was no applause at the close of Paul's speech. Only the awkward clink of soup spoons against Sèvres. He hadn't made any brilliant intellectual argument. He'd simply made an ass of himself. The meal wore on. The tinge of embarrassment kept Paul's face red all the way through the cheese course. And then Westinghouse said something that surprised not only Paul, but every other guest at the table.
Care to join me in the study, Mr. Cravath?
Still not sure that Westinghouse hadn't misspoken, Paul followed the inventor into his study. The desk alone seemed larger than Paul's entire Manhattan apartment. Thick Persian rugs padded the floor, while a bookcase stocked with engineering journals rose to the ceiling. Westinghouse shut the door behind them.
Cigar? He offered.
No, thank you, said Paul. Afraid I don't smoke.
Neither do I. Can't stand the smell, but Marguerite says it's impolite not to keep them around for guests. He poured two tumblers of an ancient scotch. Kid, I am getting the impression that you might be an honest man.
I'm flattered, sir, though I'm not sure that's a desirable reputation in my line of work.
I recently found myself in need of a man of conviction.
He paused, as if trying to determine how most aptly to broach the coming subject.
I am being sued.
Paul was well aware. In the time since his invitation to dinner, he'd devoured all the newspaper accounts of Westinghouse's legal troubles. The dispute was highly public. Thomas Edison has sued you for infringing on his patent on the incandescent light bulb.
Edison's bulbs are terrible. Poor quality designs, two generations behind mine. There are a dozen companies across this country making bulbs of more advanced design than Edison's. Mine just happened to be by far the best.
Yours are better, but Edison's were first. It's the latter issue that is of legal concern. Your difficulty is that he's the one with the patent.
I did not copy Edison's design for the light bulb. I improved upon it tremendously. My light bulb is to his, as a motor wagon is to a horse-drawn carriage. Would there be justice in forbidding Mr. Benz from selling the former because of the existence of the latter? Of course not. Edison is not suing me. He is suing progress itself because he lacks the ability to invent it.
It sounds, suggested Paul, as if you're in need of a very good attorney.
I need a very good attorney who is not afraid of Thomas Edison.
Westinghouse folded his wide body into a leather armchair. He sipped at his scotch.
If you're committed to the cause of justice, I can promise you that you will find no more just cause than our defense against Edison. Your firm is small, which is good. When I hire someone, I expect his full attention. I've done my research, too. No need to look surprised. Anyone can hire a lawyer, Mr. Cravath. I need a partner. I need a man of honor who will not be afraid to tell me difficult truths. I am the most technically adept inventor of this age.
That intimidates some people.
Will it intimidate you?
You impress me, said Paul. But you do not and will not intimidate me. Neither, for that matter, will Thomas Edison.
Westinghouse gave a small laugh. Everyone thinks that at first. Then they find out what they've gotten into.
And what would I be getting into?
It's this lawsuit. It's substantial.
Of course.
My accountants are still going through the numbers, trying to approximate the scope of the thing. It's rather impossible to place an exact value on indoor electrical light, you see.
At my previous firm with Mr. Carter, I worked on one of the Kuhn and Lowe bulge bracket suits. Paul was exaggerating. He was barely involved in the case, but Westinghouse would have no way of knowing that. It was $275,000 in damages, quite unprecedented, and we succeeded.
Westinghouse raised an eyebrow. That's a lot of money.
Yes.
Thomas Edison is suing me for $1 billion.
Westinghouse examined the look on Paul's face, and then, for the first time that evening, gave a big, wide smile.
So then, said Westinghouse, do you still want the job?
Chapter 4. A Suggestion of Compromise. One could not be a successful scientist without realizing that, in contrast to the popular conception supported by newspapers and mothers of scientists, a goodly number of scientists are not only narrow-minded and dull, but also just stupid. James Watson, co-discoverer of DNA. The requisite documents were sent to New York, the contracts exchanged and signed, coffers filled with money. Westinghouse did not merely pay on time, he paid in advance. Carter, the elder partner, was overjoyed, while Hughes, the younger one, was nakedly jealous.
Their junior partner had just signed one of the plummiest clients in the country. But the terms of their partnership had been drawn up plainly. Paul had been the one to sign Westinghouse, which meant that it was Paul's case. The elder partners could take their 84% of the fees, but they could not take the credit. In the following 3 months, Paul heard little from his sole client. He received nothing in the way of guidance. Westinghouse seemed indifferent to the specifics of the law. When Paul requested technical schematics of the various machines in question, they arrived promptly and without comment. When Paul sent copies of the briefs he wrote, no response came. Westinghouse spent their infrequent meetings in Pittsburgh largely in silence, as if expecting something from Paul, something Paul hadn't yet said. Paul's response to his client's silence was to keep talking. Verbosity was Paul's best approximation of friendliness. It was only when some scientific point would come up that Westinghouse would grow animated and speak, at length, in stentorian tones. Westinghouse seemed to have only two modes of interaction, silent or lecturing. Often Paul felt that Westinghouse wasn't listening to a word he said. Paul would ask a question and Westinghouse would silently ponder some paper upon his desk before responding on another matter entirely. Sometimes Paul felt as if he might as well be polishing his client's silver instead of attempting to save his company. The only non-scientific topic that could get a rise out of the older man was Edison. Westinghouse sneered at any mention of the name. At the suggestion, made at length by Edison's attorneys, that Edison had invented the light bulb and Westinghouse had illegally piggybacked off his work, Westinghouse would sputter with indignation. Who was right? Paul was neither a scientist nor an engineer. He had no idea. His job was to zealously defend his client, and that he would do. His own future depended upon his success, if only Westinghouse would be any kind of help. The day after the burning of the workman above Broadway and the midnight meeting with Edison, Paul immediately left for Pittsburgh. He did not do his client the courtesy of requesting an audience. He simply telegraphed that he'd be there that evening. Paul arrived to find Westinghouse in the laboratory, sleeves rolled up, top coat off, contemplating a steel disc on the work table before him. As Paul recited the events that had transpired in Edison's office, Westinghouse caressed the device in front of him, running his fingers over its rough contours. It was as if his touch might be enough to bring the unfinished mechanism to life. "Edison was trying to scare me," explained Paul, "which is not necessarily a bad thing. It means he's afraid of something himself." Westinghouse waved a hand in the air. "You say he had a switch on his desk that controlled the statue's torch? That's not possible." Paul was unsure how to respond. "What's the distance from Fifth Avenue to the Statue of Liberty?" wondered Westinghouse aloud. "Must be 4 miles? 5? There's no way Edison's electricity could cover that much land. His current could extend but a few hundred feet from its generator. What did it look like?"
"It looks like a gigantic statue of a lady holding a torch."
"No, no, the switch. What did the switch look like?"
Paul stared at his client. He tightened the Windsor knot on his long black necktie as he gathered himself. "I'm afraid I don't recall, sir."
"It's the problem of distance," lectured Westinghouse. "My own men go sleepless trying to solve it. Electrical current, or the voltage required to power a light bulb, cannot travel more than a few hundred feet before withering. Edison must have been sending a telegraph signal." "Yes, that's it. Morse code to a man at the Pearl Street station who could then turn the torch on and off for him. It's the only explanation. There is no way Edison's team has solved the distance problem. I don't believe it." Paul refrained from reacting visibly. Westinghouse, an engineer to the bone, had the tendency to maniacally fixate on minuscule technical details while ignoring larger, more pressing concerns.
There was $1 billion on the line, and he cared only about the shape of Edison's switches. What Paul needed